Grishinov watched him do it, saw his eyes water, hoping the man wouldn't cough and hurt himself more. It was good vodka, obtained from the embassy's storeroom in Hanoi, the one thing his country always had in good supply, and the one thing the embassy always had enough of. The best quality of paper vodka, Kolya's personal favorite, actually flavored with old paper, something this American was unlikely to note, and something he himself missed after the third or fourth drink, if the truth be known.
You are a good skier, Robin.
Zacharias felt the warmth in his belly as it spread out and allowed his body to relax. In that relaxation his pain lessened, and he felt a little stronger. And if this Russian wanted to talk skiing, well, that couldn't hurt much, could it?
I ski the expert slopes, Robin said with satisfaction. I started when I was a kid. I think I was 5 when Dad took me the first time.
Your father, also a pilot?
The American shook his head.
No, a lawyer.
My father is a professor of history at Moscow State University. We have a dacha, and in the winter, when I was little, I could ski in the woods. I love the silence. All you can hear is the, how you say, swish? Swish of the skis in the snow. Nothing else. Like a blanket on the earth. No noise. Just silence.
If you go up early, the mountains can be like that. You pick a day right after the snow ends. Not much wind.
Kolya smiled.
Like flying, isn't it? Flying in a single-seat aircraft, a fair day with a few white clouds.
He leaned forward with a crafty look.
Tell me, do you ever turn your radio off for a few minutes, just to be alone?
They let you do that? Zacharias asked.
Grishinov chuckled, shaking his head.
No, but I do it anyway.
Good for you, Robin said with a smile of his own, remembering what it was like. He thought of one particular afternoon, flying out of Mountain Home Air Force Base one February day in 1964.
It is how God must feel, yes, all alone. You can ignore the noise of the engine. For me, it just goes away after a few minutes. Is it the same for you?
Yeah, if your helmet fits right.
That is the real reason I fly, Grishinov lied. All the other rubbish, the paperwork and the mechanical things and the lectures, they are the price. To be up there, all alone, just like when I was a boy skiing in the woods, but better. You can see so far on a clear winter day.
He handed Zacharias the flask again.
Do you suppose these little savages understand that?
Probably not. He wavered for a moment. Well, he'd already had one. Another couldn't hurt, could it? Zacharias took another swallow.
What I do, Robin, I hold the stick just in my fingertips, like this.
He demonstrated with the top of the flask.
I close my eyes for a moment, and when I open them the world is different. Then I am not part of the world anymore. I am something else. An angel, perhaps, he said with good humor. Then I possess the sky as I would like to possess a woman, but it is never quite the same. The best feelings are supposed to be alone, I think.
This guy really understands, doesn't he? He really understands flying.
You a poet or something?
I love poetry. I do not have the talent to make it, but that does not prevent me from reading it and memorizing it, feeling what the poet tells me to feel, Grishinov said quietly,
actually meaning what he said as he watched the American's eyes lose focus, becoming dreamy.
We are much alike, my friend.
What's the story on Juju? Tucker asked.
Looks like a rip-off. He got careless. One of yours, eh? Charon said.
Yeah, he moved a lot for us.
Who did it? They were in the main branch of the Enoch Pratt Free Library, hidden in some rows, an ideal place, really. Hard to approach without being spotted, and impossible to bug. Even though a quiet place, there were just too many of the little alcoves.
No telling, Henry.
Ryan and Douglas were there, and it didn't look to me like they had much. Hey, you going to get that worked up over one pusher?
You know better than that. But it puts a little dent in things. Never had one of mine wasted before.
You know better than that, Henry.
Charon flipped through some pages. It's a high-risk business. Somebody wanted a little cash, maybe some drugs, too. Maybe break into the business quick. Look for a new pusher selling your stuff, maybe. Hell, as good as they were on the hit, maybe you could reach an understanding with them.
I have enough dealers, and making peace like that is bad for business.
How they do 'em?
Very professional. Two in the head each.
Douglas was talking like it was a mob hit.
Tucker turned his head.
Oh?
Charon spoke calmly, his back to the man. Henry, this wasn't the outfit. Tony isn't going to do anything like that, is he?
Probably not.
But Eddie might.
I need something, Charon said next.
What?
A dealer.
What did you expect? A tip on the second at Pimlico?
Too many of 'em are mine now, remember?
It had been all right, better than that, really, to use Charon to eliminate the major competition. But as Tucker had consolidated his control on the local trade, he was able to target fewer and fewer independent operators for judicial elimination. That was particularly true of the majors. He had systematically picked out people with whom he had no interest in working, and the few who were left might be useful allies rather than rivals, if he could only find a way to negotiate with them.
If you want me to be able to protect you, Henry, then I have to be able to control investigations. For me to control the investigations, I have to land some big fish from time to time.
Charon put the book back on the shelf. Why did he have to explain things like this to the man?
When?
Beginning of the week. Something tasty. I want to take down something that looks nice.
I'll get back to you.
Tucker replaced his book and walked away. Charon spent another few minutes searching for the right book. He found it, along with the envelope that sat next to it. The police lieutenant didn't bother counting. He knew that the amount would be right.
Greer handled the introductions. Mr. Clark, this is General Martin Young, and this is Robert Ritter.
Kelly shook hands with both. The Marine was an aviator, like Maxwell and Podolsky, both of whom were absent from this meeting. He hadn't a clue who Ritter was, but he was the one who spoke first.
Nice analysis. Your language wasn't exactly bureaucratic, but you hit all the high points.
Sir, it's not really all that hard to figure out. A ground assault ought to be fairly easy. You don't have first-line troops in a place like this, and those you have are looking in, not out. Figure two guys in each tower. The MGs are going to be set to point in, right? It takes a few seconds to move them. You can use the tree line to get close enough for M79 range.
Kelly moved his hands around the diagram. Here's the barracks, only two doors, and I bet there's not 40 guys in there.
Come in here. General Young tapped the southwest corner on the compound.
Yes, sir.
For an Airedale, the Marine caught on pretty fast. The trick's getting the initial strike team in close. You'll use weather for that, and this time of the year that shouldn't be real hard. Two gunships, just regular rockets and miniguns to hose these two buildings. Land the evac choppers here. It's all over in under 5 minutes from when the shooting starts. That's the land phase. I'll leave the rest to the fires.
So you say the real key is to get the assault element in close on the ground?
No, sir. If you want to do another sangte, you can duplicate the whole plan. Crash the chopper in the compound, the whole 9 yards. But I keep hearing you want it done small.
Correct, Ritter said. Has to be small. There's no way we can sell this as a major operation.
Fewer assets, sir, and you have to use different tactics. The good news is that it's a small objective. Not all that many people to get out. Not many bad guys to get in the way.
But no safety factor, General Young said, frowning.
Not much of one, Kelly agreed. 25 people. Land them in this valley. They hump over this hill, get into place, do the towers, blow this gate.
Then the gunships come in and hose these two buildings while the assault element hits this building here. The snakes orbit while the slicks do the pickup, and we all boogie the hell down the valley.
Mr. Clark, you're an optimist, Greer observed, reminding Kelly of his cover name at the same time.
If General Young found out that Kelly had been a mere chief, they'd never get his support. And Young had already stretched a long way for them, using up his whole year's construction budget to build the mock-up in the woods of Quantico.
It's all stuff I've done before, Admiral.
Who's going to get the personnel? Ritter asked.
That's being taken care of, James Greer assured him.
Ritter sat back, looking at the photos and diagrams. He was putting his career on the line, as was Greer and everyone else. But the alternative to doing something was doing nothing. Doing nothing meant that at least one good man, and perhaps 20 more, would never come home again. That wasn't the real reason, though, Ritter admitted to himself. The real reason was that others had decided that the lives of those men didn't matter, and those others might make the same decision again. That kind of thinking would someday destroy his agency. You couldn't recruit agents if the word got out that America didn't protect those who worked for her. Keeping faith was more than the right thing. It was also good business.
Better to get things going before we break the story, he said. It'll be easier to get a go mission if we've already got it ready to go. Make it look like a unique opportunity. That's the other big mistake they made with Kingpin. It was too obviously aimed at getting a hunting license, and that was never in the cards. What we have here is a one-time rescue mission. I can take that to my friends in the NSC. That'll fly, probably, but we have to be ready to go when I do that.
Bob, does that mean you're on our side? Greer asked. Ritter took a long moment before answering.
Yes, it does.
We need an additional safety factor, Young said, looking at the large-scale map, figuring how the helicopters would get in.
Yes, sir, Kelly said. Somebody has to go in early and eyeball things.
They still had both photos of Robin Zacharias out, one of an Air Force colonel, standing upright, holding his cap under his arm, chest decorated with silver wings and ribbons, smiling confidently into the camera with his family arrayed around him, and the other of a bowed, bedraggled man about to be butt-stroked from behind. Hell, he thought. Why not one more crusade?
I guess that's me.
Chapter 17 Complications.
Archie hadn't known much, but it turned out to be enough for Kelly's purposes. All he really needed now was a little more sleep. Tracking someone in a car, he found, was harder than it appeared on TV, and harder than it had been in New Orleans the one time he'd attempted it. If you followed too closely, you ran the risk of being spotted. If you held too far back, you might lose the guy. Traffic complicated everything. Trucks could obstruct your vision. Watching one car half a block away necessarily caused you to ignore cars closer to you, and those, he found, could do the damnedest things. For all that, he blessed Billy's red Roadrunner. It was easy to spot with its bright color. And even though the driver liked to lay rubber on the street and corner, he still couldn't break all that many traffic laws without attracting the attention of the police, something he didn't want to do any more than Kelly did. Kelly had sighted the car just after 7 in the evening, close to the bar which Archie had identified. Whatever he was like, Kelly thought, he didn't know much about being covert, but the car told him that. The mud was gone, he saw at once. The car looked freshly washed and waxed, and from their previous encounter, he knew Billy to be a man who treasured the thing. It offered a few interesting possibilities which Kelly considered while he trailed him, never closer than half a block, getting a feel for how he moved. It was soon apparent that he stayed clear of the major thoroughfares as much as possible, and knew the side streets as a weasel knew his den. That placed Kelly at a disadvantage. Balancing it was the fact that Kelly was driving a car nobody noticed. There were just too many used Beetles on the street for one more to attract notice. After 40 minutes, the pattern became clear. The Roadrunner turned right quickly and came to a stop at the end of the block. Kelly weighed his options and kept going slowly.
As he approached, he saw a girl get out, carrying a purse. She walked up to an old friend, the wizard, several blocks from his usual hangout. Kelly didn't see a transfer of any kind. The two walked into a building and remained hidden for a minute or two until the girl came out. But he didn't have to. The event fitted what Pam had told him. Better yet, it identified the wizard, Kelly told himself, turning left and approaching a red light. Now he knew two things he hadn't known before. In his rearview mirror, he saw the Roadrunner cross the street. The girl headed the same way, disappearing from his view as the light changed. Kelly turned right and right again, spotting the Plymouth as it proceeded south with three people inside. He hadn't noticed the man, probably a man, before, crouching in back. Darkness was falling rapidly, the good time of the day for John Kelly. He continued to follow the Roadrunner, leaving his lights off as long as he dared, and was rewarded by seeing it stop at a brownstone corner house, where all three occupants got out, having made their deliveries for the night to four pushers. He gave them a few minutes, parking his car a few blocks away and coming back on foot to observe, again disguised as a street drunk. The local architecture made it easier. All of the houses on the other side of the street had marble front steps, large rectangular blocks of stone that made for good cover and concealment. It was just a matter of sitting on the sidewalk and leaning back against them, and he could not be seen from behind. Picking the right set of steps, close but not too close to a working street light, gave him a nice shadow in which to conceal himself. And besides, who paid any attention to a street bum anyway? Kelly adopted the same sort of drunken huddle he'd seen in others, occasionally lifting his bag-covered bottle for a simulated sip while he watched the corner brownstone for several hours. Blood types O-positive, O-negative, and AB-negative, he remembered from the pathology report. The semen left inside Pam had been matched to those blood types, and he wondered what blood type Billy's was as he sat there 50 yards away from the house. The traffic moved on the street. People walked back and forth. Perhaps three people had given him a look, but nothing more than that as he feigned sleep, watching the house from the corner of his eye and listening to every sound for possible danger as the hours passed. A pusher was working the sidewalk perhaps 20 yards or so behind him, and he listened to the man's voice, for the first time hearing how he described his product and negotiated the price, listening also to the different voices of the customers. Kelly had always possessed unusually good hearing. It had saved his life more than once, and this, too, was valuable intelligence information for his mind to catalog and analyze as the hours passed. A stray dog came up to him, sniffing in a curious, friendly way, and Kelly didn't chew it away. That would have been out of character. Had it been a rat, things might have been different, he thought, and maintaining his disguise was important. What sort of neighborhood had this been, Kelly wondered. On his side, the dwellings were fairly ordinary brick row houses. The other side was a little different, the more substantial brownstones perhaps 50% wider. Maybe this street had been the border between ordinary working people and the more substantial members of the turn-of-the-century middle class. Maybe that brownstone had been the upscale home of a merchant or a sea captain. Maybe it had resonated to the sound of a piano on the weekends, from a daughter who'd studied at the Peabody Conservatory. But they'd all moved on to places where there was grass, and this house, too, was now vacant, a brown, three-story ghost of a different time. He was surprised at how wide the streets were, perhaps because when they'd been laid out, the principal mode of transport had been horse-powered wagons. Kelly shook the thought off. It was not relevant, and his mind had to concentrate on what was. 4 hours, finally, had passed when the three came out again, the man in the lead, the girl following. Shorter than Pam, stockier. Kelly risked himself slightly by lifting his head to watch. He needed to get a good look at Billy, who he assumed to be the driver. Not a very impressive figure, really. Perhaps 5'9", slim at 150 or so. Something shiny at his wrist, a watch or bracelet. He moved with brisk economy, and arrogance. The other was taller and more substantial, but a subordinate, Kelly thought, from the way he moved and the way he followed. The girl, he saw, followed more docilely still, her head down. Her blouse, if that's what it was, wasn't fully buttoned, and she got into the car without raising her head to look around or do anything else that might proclaim interest in the world around her. The girl's movements were slow and uneven, probably from drugs. But that wasn't all of it. There was something else, something Kelly didn't quite catch about her that was disturbing nonetheless. A slackness, perhaps. Not laziness in her movement, but something else. Kelly blinked hard when he remembered where he'd seen it before. At the Ville, during Plastic Flower, the way the villagers had moved to assemble when they'd been summoned. Resigned, automatic motion, like living robots under the control of that major and his troops. They would have moved the same way to their deaths. And so she moved, and so would she. So it was all true then, Kelly thought. They really did use girls as couriers, among other things. The car started as he watched, and Billy's manner with the car matched the name to the driver. The car jerked a few feet to the corner, then turned left, accelerating with the squeal of tires across the intersection and out of Kelly's sight. Billy, 5'9", slim, watch or bracelet, arrogant. The positive identification was set in Kelly's brain, along with the face and the hair. He wouldn't forget it. The other male form was recorded as well, the one without a name. Just a destiny far more immediate than its owner knew. Kelly checked the watch in his pocket. 1:40. What had they been doing in there? Then he remembered other things that Pam had said. A little party, probably. That girl, whoever she was, probably also had O-positive, O-negative, or AB-negative fluid in her. But Kelly couldn't save the whole world, and the best way to save her had nothing at all to do with freeing her directly. He relaxed himself, just a little, waiting, because he didn't want his movement to appear to be linked with anything in case someone might have seen him, even be watching him now. There were lights in some of these houses, and so he lingered in his spot for another 30 minutes, enduring his thirst and some minor cramps before rising and shambling off to the corner. He'd been very careful tonight, very careful and very effective, and it was time for the second phase of the night's work. Time to continue his efforts at making a diversion. Mainly he stuck to alleys, moving slowly, allowing his gait to wander left and right for several blocks in the undulating path of a snake, he smiled, before he went back to the streets, only pausing briefly to put on the pair of rubber surgical gloves. He passed a number of pushers and their lieutenants as time passed, looking for the right one. His path was what is called a quartering search, a series of 90-degree turns centered actually on where his Volkswagen was parked. He had to be careful, as always, but he was the unknown hunter, and the prey animals had no idea what they were, deeming themselves to be predators themselves. They were entitled to their illusions. It was almost 3 when Kelly selected him, a loner, as Kelly had taken to calling them. This one had no lieutenant. Perhaps was a new one in this business, just learning the ropes. He wasn't that old, or didn't appear so, from 40 yards away, as he counted through his roll after the night's enterprise. There was a lump at his right hip, undoubtedly a handgun, but his head was down. He was somewhat alert. On hearing Kelly's approach, the head came up and turned, giving him a quick once-over. But the head went back to its task, dismissing the approaching shape, and counting the money as the distance closed. Kelly had troubled himself to go to his boat earlier in the day, using the scout because he didn't want anyone at the yard to know that he had a different car, and retrieving something. As he approached Junior, everyone had to have an assigned name, however briefly, Kelly shifted the wine bottle from his right hand to his left. The right hand then pulled the cotter pin from the tip of the bang stick that was inside his new bush jacket, held in cloth loops on the left side on the now unbuttoned garment. It was a simple metal rod, 18 inches long, with a screw-on cylinder at the tip, and the cutter pin dangled from a short length of light chain. Kelly's right hand removed it from the loops, still holding it in place as he closed on Junior. The pusher's head turned again in annoyance. Probably he had trouble counting, and now he was arranging the bills by denomination. Maybe Kelly's approach had disturbed his concentration, or maybe he was just dumb, which seemed the more likely explanation. Kelly stumbled, falling to the sidewalk, his head lowered, making himself look all the more harmless. His eyes looked backwards as he rose. He saw no other pedestrians within more than 100 yards, and the only automobile lights he noted were red, not white, all pointed or heading away. As his head came up, there was no one at all in his view except for Junior, who was finishing up the night's work, ready to go wherever home was for a nightcap or something else. 10 feet now, and the pusher was ignoring him as he might ignore a stray dog. And Kelly knew the exhilaration that came the moment before it happened, that last moment of excited satisfaction when you just knew it was going to work. The enemy in the kill zone, unsuspecting that his time had come. The moment in which you could feel the blood in your veins, when you alone knew the silence was about to be violated. The wonderful satisfaction of knowing. Kelly's right hand came out a little as he took another step, still not headed all that close to the target, clearly walking past him, not towards him, and the criminal's eyes looked up again, just for a moment to make sure. No fear in his eyes, hardly even annoyance. Not moving, of course, because people walked around him, not the reverse. Kelly was just an object to him, one of the things that occupied the street, of no more interest than an oil stain on the blacktop. The Navy called it CPA, closest point of approach, the nearest distance that a straight course took you to another ship or point of land. CPA here was 3 feet. When he was half a step away, Kelly's right hand pulled the bang stick from under his jacket. Then he pivoted on his left foot and drove off the right, while his right arm extended almost as though to deliver a punch, all 195 pounds of his body mass behind the maneuver. The swollen tip of the bang stick struck the pusher just under the sternum, aimed sharply upward. When it did, the combined push of Kelly's arm and the inertial mass of the body pushed the chamber backwards, jamming the primer on the fixed firing pin, and the shotgun shell went off, its crimped green plastic face actually in contact with Junior's shirt. The sound was like that of dropping a cardboard box on a wooden floor. Whump. Nothing more than that. Certainly not like a shot at all, because all the expanding gas from the powder followed the shot column into Junior's body. The light trapload, a low brass shell with No. 8 birdshot, like that used for competition shooting, or perhaps an early season dove hunt, would have only injured a man at more than 15 yards, but in contact with his chest, it might as easily have been an elephant gun. The brutal power of the shot drove the air from his lungs in a surprisingly loud whoosh, forcing Junior's mouth open in a way that surprise might have done. And truly, he was surprised. His eyes looked into Kelly's, and Junior was still alive, though his heart was already as destroyed as a toy balloon, and the bottom of his lungs torn to bits. Gratifyingly, there was no exit wound. The upward angle of the strike left all of the energy and shot inside the chest, and the power of the explosion served to keep his body erect for a second. No more than that, but for Junior and Kelly, it seemed a moment that lasted for hours. Then the body just fell, straight down, like a collapsing building. There was an odd, deep sigh, from air and gun gases forced out of the entrance wound by the fall. A foul odor of acrid smoke and blood and other things that stained the air, not unlike the ended life it represented. Junior's eyes were still open, still looking at Kelly, still focusing on his face and trying to say something, his mouth open and quivering until all movement stopped with the question unasked and answered. Kelly took the roll from Junior's still firm hand and kept moving up the street, his eyes and ears searching for danger, and finding none. At the corner he angled to the gutter and swished the tip of the bang stick in some water to remove whatever blood might be there. Then he turned, heading west to his car, still moving slowly and unevenly. 40 minutes later, he was home, richer by $840 and poorer by one shotgun shell.
"And who's this one?" Ryan asked.
"Would you believe Bandana?" the uniformed officer answered. He was an experienced patrol officer, white, 32 years old.
"Deal smack. Well, not anymore."
The eyes were still open, which was not terribly common in murder victims, but this one's death had been a surprise, and a very traumatic one at that, despite which the body was amazingly tidy. There was a 3/4-inch entrance wound with a jet-black ring around it like a donut, perhaps an 1/8 inch in thickness. That was from powder, and the diameter of the hole was unmistakably that of a 12-gauge shotgun. Beyond the skin was just a hole, like into an empty box. All of the internal organs had either been immolated or simply pulled down by gravity. It was the first time in his life that Emmett Ryan had ever looked into a dead body this way, as though it were not a body at all, but a mannequin.
"Cause of death," the coroner observed with early morning irony, "is the total vaporization of his heart. The only way we'll even be able to identify heart tissue is under a microscope."
"Steak tartare," the man added, shaking his head.
"An obvious contact wound. The guy must have jammed the muzzle right into him, then triggered it off."
"Jesus, he didn't even cough up any blood," Douglas said. The lack of an exit wound left no blood at all on the sidewalk, and from a distance Bandana actually looked as though he were asleep, except for the wide and lifeless eyes.
"No diaphragm," the ME explained, pointing to the entrance hole. "That's between here and the heart. We'll probably find that the whole respiratory system is wiped out, too. You know, I've never seen anything this clean in my life." And the man had been working this job for 16 years. "We need lots of pictures. This one will find its way into a textbook."
"How experienced was he?" Ryan asked the uniformed officer.
"Long enough to know better."
The detective lieutenant bent down, feeling around the left hip.
"Still has a gun here."
"Somebody he knew?" Douglas wondered. "Somebody he let get real close, that's for damn sure."
"A shotgun's kind of hard to conceal. Hell, even a sawed-off is bulky.
No warning at all?" Ryan stepped back for the ME to do his work.
"Hands are clean, no signs of a struggle. Whoever did this got real close without alarming our friend at all."
Douglas paused.
"God damn it, a shotgun's noisy. Nobody heard anything?"
"Time of death, call it 2 or 3 for now," the medical examiner estimated, for again there was no rigor.
"Streets are quiet then," Douglas went on, "and a shotgun makes a shitload of noise."
Ryan looked at the pants' pockets. No bulge of a money roll again. He looked around. There were perhaps 15 people watching from behind the police line. Street entertainment was where you found it, and the interest on their faces was no less clinical and no more involved than that of the medical examiner.
"The duo, maybe?" Ryan asked. "Nobody in particular?"
"No, it wasn't," the ME said at once. "This was a single-barrel weapon. A double would have left a mark left or right of the entrance wound, and the powder distribution would have been different. Shotgun, this close, you only need one. Anyway, a single-barrel weapon."
"Amen," Douglas agreed. "Someone is doing the Lord's work. 3 pushers down in a couple of days. Might put Mark Charon out of business if this keeps up."
"Tom," Ryan said, "not today." One more folder, he thought. Another drug pusher ripoff, done very efficiently, but not the same guy who'd taken Juju down. Different M.O. Another shower, another shave. Another jog in Chinquapin Park, during which he could think. Now he had a place and a face to go along with the car. The mission was on profile, Kelly thought, turning right on Belvedere Avenue to cross the stream before jogging back the other way and completing his 3rd lap. It was a pleasant park. Not much in the way of playground equipment, but that allowed kids to run and play freeform, which a number of them were doing. Some under the semi-watchful eyes of a few neighborhood mothers,
many with books to go along with the sleeping infants who would soon grow to enjoy the grass and open spaces. There was an undermanned pickup game of baseball. The ball evaded the glove of a 9-year-old and came close to his jogging path. Kelly bent down without breaking stride and tossed the ball to the kid, who caught it this time and yelled a thank you. A younger child was playing with a frisbee, not too well, and wandered in Kelly's way, causing a quick avoidance maneuver that occasioned an embarrassed look from her mother, to which Kelly responded with a friendly wave and smile. "This is how it's supposed to be," he told himself. Not very different from his own youth in Indianapolis. Dad's at work, Mom's with the kids because it was hard to be a good mom and have a job, especially when they were little. Or at least those mothers who had to work or chose to work could leave the kids with a trusted friend, sure that the little ones would be safe to play and enjoy their summer vacation in a green and open place, learning to play ball. And yet society had learned to accept the fact that it wasn't this way for many. This area was so different from his area of operations, and the privileges these kids enjoyed ought not to be privileges at all. For how could a child grow to proper adulthood without an environment like this? Those were dangerous thoughts, Kelly told himself. The logical conclusion was to try to change the whole world, and that was beyond his capacity, he thought, finishing his 3-mile run with the usual sweaty and good tired feel, walking it off to cool down before he drove back to the apartment. The sounds drifted over of laughing children, the squeals, the angry shouts of, "Cheater!" for some perceived violation of rules not fully understood by either player, and disagreements over who was out or who was it in some other game. He got into his car, leaving the sounds and thought behind, because he was cheating too, wasn't he? He was breaking the rules, important rules that he did fully understand, but doing so in pursuit of justice, or what he called justice in his own mind. Vengeance, Kelly asked himself, crossing a street. Vigilante was the next word that came unbidden into his mind. That was a better word, Kelly thought. It came from vigiles, a Roman term for those who kept the watch, the vigilia during the night in the city streets, mainly watchmen for fire, if he remembered correctly from the Latin classes at St. Ignatius High School. But being Romans, they'd probably carried swords, too. He wondered if the streets of Rome had been safe, safer than the streets of this city. Perhaps so. Probably so. Roman justice had been stern. Crucifixion would not have been a pleasant way to die, and for some crimes, like the murder of one's father, the penalty prescribed by law was to be bound in a cloth sack along with a dog and a rooster, and some other animal, then to be tossed in the Tiber. Not to drown, but to be torn apart while drowning by animals crazed to get out of the sack. Perhaps he was the linear descendant of such times, of a vigile, Kelly told himself, keeping watch at night. It made him feel better than to believe that he was breaking the law, and vigilantes in American history books were very different from those portrayed in the press. Before the organization of real police departments, private citizens had patrolled the streets and kept the peace in a rough and ready way. As he was doing? Well, no, not really, Kelly admitted to himself, parking the car. So what if it was vengeance? 10 minutes later, another garbage bag filled with another set of discarded clothes found its way to the dumpster, and Kelly enjoyed another shower before making a telephone call. Nurse's Station, O'Toole. Sandy, it's John. Still getting out at 3? You do have good timing, she said, allowing herself a private smile at her stand-up desk. The damn car is broke again. And taxicabs cost too much. Want me to look at it? Kelly asked. I wish somebody could fix it. I make no promises, she heard him say, but I come cheap. How cheap? Sandy asked, knowing what the reply would be. Permit me to buy you dinner? You can pick the place, even.
Yes, okay, but...
But it's still too soon for both of us. Yes, ma'am, I know that. Your virtue is not endangered, honest.
She had to laugh. It was just so incongruous that this big man could be so self-effacing. And yet she knew that she could trust him, and she was weary of cooking dinner for one, and being alone, and alone, and alone. Too soon or not, she needed company sometimes. 3:15, she told him, at the main entrance. I'll even wear my patient bracelet. Okay. Another laugh, surprising another nurse who passed by the station with a tray full of medications. Okay, I said yes, didn't I?
Yes, ma'am.
See you then, Kelly said with a chuckle, hanging up. Some human contact would be nice, he told himself, heading out the door. First, Kelly headed to a shoe store, where he purchased a pair of black high tops, size 11. Then he found 4 more shoe stores, where he did the same, trying not to get the same brand, but he ended up with 1 duplicate pair even so. The same problem attended the purchase of bush jackets. He could find only 2 brand names for that type of garment, and ended up getting a pair of duplicates, then to discover that they were exactly the same, different only in the name tag inside the neck. Planned diversity in disguise, he found, was harder than he'd expected it to be. But that didn't lessen the necessity of sticking to his plan. On getting back to his apartment, he was perversely thinking of it as home, though he knew better, he stripped everything of tags and headed for the laundry room, where all the clothes went into the machine on a hot, hot cycle with plenty of Clorox bleach, along with the remaining dark color clothes he'd picked up at yard sales. He was down to 3 clothing sets now, and realized he'd have to shop for more. The thought evoked a frown. More yard sales, which he found tedious, especially now that he'd developed an operational routine. Like most men, Kelly hated shopping, now all the more since his adventures were of necessity repetitive. His routine was also tiring him out, both from lack of sleep and the unremitting tension of his activity. None of it was routine, really. Everything was dangerous. Even though he was becoming accustomed to his mission, he would not become inured to the dangers, and the stress was there. That was partly good news in that he wasn't taking anything lightly, but stress could also wear at any man in little, hard-to-perceive ways, such as the increased heart rate and blood pressure that resulted in fatigue. He was controlling it with exercise, Kelly thought, though sleep was becoming a problem. All in all, it was not unlike working the weeds in Third Sog. But he was older now, and the lack of backup, the absence of companions to share the stress and ease the strain in the off hours, was taking its toll. Sleep, he told himself, checking his watch. Kelly switched on the TV set in the bedroom, catching a noon news show. Another drug dealer was found dead in West Baltimore today, the reporter announced. I know, Kelly said back, fading out for his nap. Here's the story, a Marine colonel said at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, while another was doing much the same thing at exactly the same time at Camp Pendleton, California. We have a special job. We're selecting volunteers exclusively from Force Recon. We need 15 people. It's dangerous. It's important. It's something you'll be proud of doing after it's over. The job will last 2 to 3 months. That's all I can say. At Lejeune, a collection of perhaps 75 men, all combat veterans, all members of the Corps' most exclusive unit, sat in their hard-backed chairs. Recon Marines, they'd all volunteered to become Marines first. There were no draftees here. Then done so again to join the elite within the elite. There was a slightly disproportionate representation of minorities, but that was only a matter of interest to sociologists. These men were Marines first, last, always, as alike as their green suits could make them. Many bore scars on their bodies, because their job was more dangerous and demanding than that of ordinary infantrymen. They specialized in going out in small groups, to look and learn, or to kill with a very high degree of selectivity. Many of them were qualified snipers, able to place an aimed shot in a particular head at 400 yards, or a chest at over 1,000,
If the target had the good manners to stand still for the second or two needed for the bullet to cover the longer distance. They were the hunters. Few had nightmares from their duties, and none would ever fall victim to delayed stress syndrome, because they deemed themselves to be predators, not prey, and lions know no such feelings. But they were also men. More than half had wives and or children who expected Daddy to come home from time to time. The rest had sweethearts and looked forward to settling down in the indeterminate future. All had served 1 13-month tour of duty. Many had served 2. A handful had actually served 3, and none of this last group would volunteer. Some of them might have, perhaps most, had they only known the nature of the mission, because the call of duty was unusually strong in them. But duty takes many forms, and these men judged that they had served as much as any man should for one war. Now their job was to train their juniors, passing along the lessons that had enabled them to return home when others almost as good as they were had not. That was their institutional duty to the Corps, they all thought, as they sat quietly in their chairs and looked at the colonel on the stage, wondering what it was. Intensely curious, but not curious enough to place their lives at risk again after having done so too often already. A few of them looked furtively left and right, reading the faces of the younger men, knowing from the expressions which ones would linger in the room and place their names in the hat. Many would regret not staying behind, knowing even now that not knowing what it was all about, and probably never finding out, would forever leave a blank spot on their consciences. But against that, they weighed the faces of their wives and children and decided no, not this time. After a few moments, the men rose and filed out. Perhaps 25 or 30 stayed behind to register their names as volunteers. Their personnel jackets would be collected quickly and evaluated, and 15 of their number would be selected in a process that appeared random but was not. Some special slots had to be filled with special skills, and in the nature of volunteering, some of the men rejected would actually be better and more proficient warriors than some of those accepted because their personal skills had been made redundant by another volunteer. Such was life in uniform, and the men all accepted it, each with feelings of regret and relief as they returned to their normal duties. By the end of the day, the men who were going were assembled and briefed on departure times and nothing more. A bus would be taking them, they noted. They couldn't be going very far. At least, not yet. Kelly awoke at 2 and got himself cleaned up. This afternoon's mission demanded that he look civilized, and so he wore a shirt and a tie and a jacket. His hair, still growing back from being shaved, needed a trim, but it was a little late for that. He selected a blue tie for his blue blazer and white shirt, and walked out to where the scout was parked, looking like the executive salesman he'd pretended to be, waving at the apartment manager on the way. Luck smiled on Kelly. There was an opening on the traffic loop at the hospital's main entrance, and he walked in to see a large statue of Christ in the lobby, perhaps 15 or 20 feet high, staring down at him with a benign expression more fitting to a hospital than to what Kelly had been doing only 12 hours earlier. He walked around it, his back to the statue's back, because he didn't need that sort of question on his conscience. Not now. Sandy O'Toole appeared at 3:12, and when he saw her come through the oak doors, Kelly smiled until he saw the look on her face. A moment later, he understood why. A surgeon was right behind her, a short, swarthy man in greens, walking as rapidly as his short legs permitted and talking loudly at her. Kelly hesitated, looking on with curiosity as Sandy stopped and turned, perhaps tired of running away or merely bending to the necessity of the moment. The doctor was of her height, perhaps a little less, speaking so rapidly that Kelly didn't catch all the words, while Sandy looked in his eyes with a blank expression. "The incident report is filed, doctor," she said during a brief pause in his tirade. "You have no right to do that!" The eyes blazed angrily in his dark, pudgy face, causing Kelly to draw a little closer.
Yes, I do, Doctor. Your medication order was incorrect. I am the team leader, and I am required to report medication errors.
I am ordering you to withdraw that report. Nurses do not give orders to doctors.
What followed was language that Kelly didn't like, especially in the presence of God's image. As he watched, the doctor's dark face grew darker, and he leaned into the nurse's space, his voice growing louder. For her part, Sandy didn't flinch, refusing to allow herself to be intimidated, which goaded the doctor further.
Excuse me.
Kelly intruded on the dispute, not too close, just to let everyone know that someone was here, and momentarily drawing an angry look from Sandra O'Toole.
I don't know what you two are arguing about, but if you're a doctor and the lady here is a nurse, maybe you two can disagree in a more professional way, he suggested in a quiet voice.
It was as though the physician hadn't heard a thing. Not since he was 16 years old had anyone ignored Kelly so blatantly. He drew back, wanting Sandy to handle this herself. But the doctor's voice merely grew louder, switching now to a language he didn't understand, mixing English vituperation with Farsi. Through it all, Sandy stood her ground, and Kelly was proud of her, though her face was growing wooden and her impassive mien had to be masking some real fear now. Her impassive resistance only goaded the doctor into raising his hand, and then his voice even more. It was when he called her a fucking cunt, doubtless something learned from a local citizen, that he stopped. The fist that he'd been waving an inch from Sandy's nose had disappeared, encased, he saw with surprise, in the hairy forepaw of a very large man.
"Excuse me," Kelly said in his gentlest voice. "Is there somebody upstairs who knows how to fix a broken hand?"
Kelly had wrapped his fingers around the surgeon's smaller, more delicate hand, and was pressing the fingers inward, just a little. A security guard came through the door just then, drawn by the noise of the argument. The doctor's eyes went that way at once.
"He won't get here fast enough to help you, doctor."
"How many bones in the human hand, sir?" Kelly asked.
28, the doctor replied automatically.
"Want to go for 56? Kelly tightened his pressure. The doctor's eyes closed on Kelly's, and the smaller man saw a face whose expression was neither angry nor pleased, merely there, looking at him as though he were an object, whose polite voice was a mocking expression of superiority. Most of all, he knew that the man would do it.
"Apologize to the lady," Kelly said next.
"I do not abase myself before women," the doctor hissed.
A little more pressure on the hand caused his face to change. Only a little additional force, he knew, and things would begin to separate.
"You have very bad manners, sir. You only have a little time to learn better ones." Kelly smiled. "Now," he commanded. "Please?"
"I'm sorry, Nurse O'Toole," the man said, without really meaning it. But the humiliation was still a bleeding gash on his character. Kelly released the hand. Then he lifted the doctor's name tag and read it before staring again into his eyes.
"Doesn't that feel better, Dr. Kofan?
Now you won't ever yell at her again, at least not when she's right and you're wrong, will you? And you won't ever threaten her with bodily harm, will you?" Kelly didn't have to explain why that was a bad idea. The doctor was flexing his fingers to work off the pain. "We don't like that here, okay?"
"Yes, okay," the man said, wanting to run away.
Kelly took his hand again, shaking it with a smile. Just enough pressure for a reminder.
"I'm glad you understand, sir. I think you can go now."
And Dr. Kofan left, walking past the security guard without so much as a look. The guard did give one to Kelly, but let it go at that.
"Did you have to do that?" Sandy asked.
"What do you mean?" Kelly replied, turning his head around.
"I was handling it," she said, now moving to the door.
"Yes, you were. What's the story, anyway?" Kelly asked in a reasonable voice.
"He prescribed the wrong medication. Elderly man with a neck problem. He's allergic to the med, and it's on the chart," she said, the words spilling out rapidly as Sandy's stress started bleeding off. "It could have really hurt Mr. Johnston. Not the first time with him, either. Dr. Rosen might get rid of him this time, and he wants to stay here. He likes pushing nurses around, too. We don't like that. But I was handling it.
Next time I'll let him break your nose, then. Kelly waved to the door. There wouldn't be a next time. He'd seen that in the little bastard's eyes.
And then what? Sandy asked.
Then he'll stop being a surgeon for a while. Sandy, I don't like seeing people do things like that, okay? I don't like bullies, and I really don't like seeing them push women around.
You really hurt people like that?
Kelly opened the door for her. No, not very often. Mainly they listen to my warnings. Look at it this way. If he hits you, you get hurt, and he gets hurt. This way, nobody gets hurt except for a few bent feelings, maybe, and nobody ever died from that. Sandy didn't press the issue. Partly she was annoyed, feeling that she'd stood up well to the doctor, who wasn't all that good a surgeon and was far too careless on his post-op technique. He only did charity patients and only those with simple problems, but that, she knew, was beside the point. Charity patients were people, and people merited the best care the profession could provide. He had frightened her. Sandy had been glad of the protection, but somehow felt cheated that she hadn't faced Kofan down herself. Her incident report would probably sink him once and for all, and the nurses on the unit would trade chuckles about it. Nurses in hospitals, like NCOs in any military unit, really ran things after all, and it was a foolish doctor who crossed them. But she'd learned something about Kelly this day. The look she'd seen and been unable to forget had not been an illusion. Holding Kofan's right hand, the look on John's face had been, well, no expression at all. Not even amusement at his humiliation of the little worm. And that was vaguely frightening to her. "So what's wrong with your car?" Kelly asked, pulling onto Broadway and heading north.
"If I knew that, it wouldn't be broke."
"Yeah, I guess that makes sense," Kelly allowed with a smile.
"He's a changeling," Sandy told herself. "He turns things on and off. With Kofan, he was like a gangster or something. First he tried to calm things down with a reasonable word, but then he acted like he was going to inflict a permanent injury. Just like that. No emotion at all. Like squashing a bug. But if that's true, what is he? Was it temper?" "No," she told herself, "probably not. He's too in control for that." A psychopath? That was a scary thought. But no, that wasn't possible either. Sam and Sarah wouldn't have a friend like that, and they're two very smart people.
What then? "Well, I brought my toolbox. I'm pretty good on diesels, aside from our little friend. How was work?"
"A good day," Sandy said, glad again for the distraction. "We discharged one we were really worried about. Little black girl, 3, fell out of her crib. Dr. Rosen did a wonderful job on her. In a month or two, you'll never know she was hurt at all."
"Sam's a good troop," Kelly observed. "Not just a good doc. He's got class, too."
"So's Sarah."
"Good troop. That's what Tim would have said." "Great lady." Kelly nodded, turning left onto North Avenue. "She did a lot for Pam," he said, this time reporting facts without the time for reflection. Then Sandy saw his face change again, freezing in place as though he'd heard the words from another's voice. "The pain won't ever go away, will it?" Kelly asked himself. Again he saw her in his mind, and for a brief, cruel second he told himself, lied, knowing it even as it happened, that she was beside him, sitting there on the right seat. But it wasn't Pam. Never would be again. His hands tightened on the plastic of the steering wheel, the knuckles suddenly white as he commanded himself to set it aside. Such thoughts were like minefields. You wandered into them, innocent, expecting nothing, then found out too late that there was danger. It would be better not to remember, Kelly thought. I'd really be better off that way. But if without memories, good and bad, what was life? And if you forgot those who mattered to you, then what did you become? And if you didn't act on those memories, what value did life have? Sandy saw it all on his face. A changeling, perhaps, but not always guarded.
"You're not a psychopath. You feel pain, and they don't. At least not from the death of a friend." What are you, then?
Chapter 18 Interference. Do it again, he told her. Funk.